Today, for the second time, we are interviewing Dr. Don Lincoln. He is a senior scientist at Fermilab, America's famous particle physics laboratory. Dr. Lincoln has over 30 years of experience exploring the most fundamental laws of nature. He is an active writer about scientific topics aimed at non-scientist audience. He has written many books, magazine articles, and blog posts. He has contributed to CNN, Nova, and Life Science. In addition, he used the power of internet to bring engaging videos to a broad audience. To welcome everybody and thanks Don for being with me for the second time. I think today we had an interesting topic to speak about, which most of us are maybe a little bit, you're more expert than me on that topic for sure, than the previous meeting or the previous interview. So today we are speaking about the new results released by the Fermilab on the J-2 experiment related to the muon spin. So I would like to hear from you first. Maybe we start with some historical background about the muon, why we are interested to do a measurement that's related to the muon spin in general. So I think you can start.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Nassim. So let me talk a little bit about this. So some people don't realize that subatomic particles, you know, they have certain properties. They have mass, they have charge. One of the things they have is a thing called spin. But we don't actually measure spin. What we measure is the magnetic properties. And this is because the reason that we even call it there is spin is because we can measure that things like a muon has magnetic properties and it has a charge. And so classically, we know that the only way that you can get magnetic, something to be magnetic, is to have a charge and to have it moving. So we infer that there's spin. But what we really know is that the muon has magnetic properties. So if you go back, way back 100 years ago, into the 1920s, people were trying to figure out what the spin to the magnetic properties of electrons were. And this was something you could do with classical quantum mechanics. Well, you could do it with classical mechanics and you would get one answer where you would have that the amount of spin equals a constant, or I should say the amount of magnetism equals a constant times the amount of spin. And originally you would think in classical terms that this constant would be one, but it turned out in quantum mechanics it's two. And this is a bizarreness of just exactly how the quantum particles work.
That's so not directly related. We have a factor in front that's supposed to be two.
It's supposed to be two. And that is, you know, circa, oh, I don't know, 1925, perhaps 1928. Mm-hmm. I don't remember when it was actually calculated. And the fact that it was two and not one was already bizarre because that meant that quantum mechanics and classical physics were different. So that's step one. Now, in the 1940s, specifically in 1948, people were measuring this G factor. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that they didn't get the right answer. In fact, what they got was a number which was 2.002 and then some other numbers. So 0.1% difference. And so what we found, the reason that that is true is because of even more bizarre parts. Quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, you have, is the cat alive and dead? And there's a particle, a wave, or is there a particle? You have all that business. But what we found in the 1940s was what we call the second quantum revolution, which says that empty space is not empty at all. And in fact, if you look in this space right here, if you look at a very small microscope, what you find is that there are particles called virtual particles that are appearing and disappearing and they do that so quickly that they essentially don't exist. And so it would be very reasonable to think that that sounds like a crazy thing, that they're not even there. You can't see them. How can they possibly be there? However, if you have a very particle like an electron, which has an electric charge, what happens is it makes an electric field around it. Mm-hmm. And that electric field causes these virtual particles that you can't see to actually rearrange themselves a little bit. So those virtual particles with a positive charge will get a little bit closer to the electron. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are negative will get a little farther away because of electric charge. And what that does is essentially the electron alters this what we call vacuum, these particles around space. And that is the origin of this 0.1%. So that's the first thing, is that charged particles alter space. And that's where you go from the 2 to 2.002. Now, this, for historical reasons, we call this thing, this 2 was G.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in not the effectively old school classical quantum mechanics, then you don't care about the 2 so much. Mm-hmm. You care about the 0.002. And so you subtract off the 2. And that's where the name G minus 2 comes from. So I'll say G minus 2 a lot. And it has to do with the fact that what we're interested in is the way in which space is altered by the charge of a particle. So this is an electron. And this was discovered in 1948. And the discovery of this slight shift in the G factor of an electron led scientists to create a new advanced type of quantum mechanics, which is called quantum electrodynamics. Mm-hmm. And the difference between quantum mechanics and quantum electrodynamics is, in quantum mechanics, things like electrons and protons were quantized. They came in discrete mm-hmm. chunks, but the fields in which they were around were smooth and continuous, so that you could always break them into smaller and smaller pieces forever. In quantum electrodynamics, or QED, you still have the fact that the electron and the proton are quantum particles, but now the field itself is quantized. So in the same way that we know what water is like, I mean, you can put water in a cup and it's smooth and everything, but you also know that if you look at it very, very close with a very fine microscope, there are water molecules. There's the smallest bit of water. And that's the same thing. The field has these little bits. These are these particles that are appearing and disappearing. And so quantum electrons.
So we moved from a classical point when we wouldn't have a factor at all, a factor would be one, to quantum point of view when we're going to have a constant, a factor that we call G mm-hmm. for historical reasons. And then mm-hmm. we found experimentally it is different. So we subtract the two, we remain with the difference, we call it G minus two. And then we learned that this difference theoretically had to come from quantized the field around the
correct
around the charge.
Correct. So this allowed us to explore mm-hmm. the idea that the fields were quantized. This is called second quantization.
Yep.
And so that is now a modern understanding of how electric fields work. And that if you were to ask a particle physicist, and they were being casual, they would say that an electric field is just full of photons. And these photons are mm-hmm. quanta of the electric field. So the fact that, I mean, we knew about photons a long time ago because they were discovered as a type of radiation. But in the 40s, we came to realize that photons were the smallest particle of electric fields. So this is all very fascinating.
Yeah.
Now the thing is, this is electrons. However, muons are different. So muons are essentially cousins of the electron. So they're heavier. They're about 200 times heavier. They are ephemeral. They live for 2.2 microseconds. So about 2 millionths of a second, a very short amount of time. But in any other respect, they're basically an electron. So they also have these magnetic properties. And so over the years, people attempted to measure these magnetic properties with more and more precision, because that would give us a better and better insight into the nature of this quantum field. Mm-hmm. And so With it was a constant battle, competition perhaps, between the ability to calculate and the ability to measure.
Sure, yeah.
And so in, say, the late 1990s, people studying the magnetic properties of the muon had been able to both calculate and measure the magnetic, this G factor, to 10 decimals.
Wow.
So there's, 2.00, so there's three decimals, but then seven more numbers. And if you looked at the data and the prediction, they agreed digit for digit, which is telling you that you are making fantastically precise measurements and you are making incredibly precise predictions. However, once you get to the last digit or two, they disagreed. And so, well, that's not so shocking. I mean, if you're doing something to 10 digits, probably you made a measurement wrong. Probably the calculation isn't quite right. We're not really sure what it is. But when you do a prediction and when you do a calculation, you can also add an uncertainty. You can say that my measurement is good to this amount, and if the real answer might be a little bit different by a certain amount. However, when that occurred, and this was around the year 2000, if they were to look at the theoretical prediction of this G factor for muons, say it should be here, but with a certain space, the experimental prediction is here with a certain space, and they're separated. They're not on top of each other. They don't agree. So you would expect, I mean, if the prediction and the theory were the same, they might not be exactly the same, but they'd be near each other.
Overlapping, a little bit of overlap.
Right, a little overlap, or even just touching like this, but they're different. They're just simply different. And so the fact that these two things are different, well, there are three possibilities for this. Possibility one is the measurement is wrong. Possibility two is the prediction is wrong. Or possibility three, that there is science, there's physics that we haven't yet discovered, something, some types of particles in that field surrounding the muons that isn't in our theory yet. So those are the options: wrong theory, wrong measurement, or
New effect.
missing physics.
Yeah, okay.
So that's what happened. And so in, I think it was 2004, the experiment that was running at the time, this was called the Muon G minus 2 experiment, which was undertaken at the Brookhaven National Lab on Long Island outside of New York City. And they made this very precise measurement. And what they found was that the data and the prediction disagreed, and they disagreed by more than could be accounted for by the uncertainties. And then that's where they were. They did were unable to resolve whether or not it was a measurement error, a theory error, or something new.
So the first thing I think we're going to need to reproduce the data. That's one of the
Exactly.
okay.
But unfortunately, the problem is that the accelerator on Long Island at Brookhaven was not sufficiently powerful to make a lot more of these muons. It was running as much as it could. So scientists had the bright idea, well, we have a much more powerful accelerator at Fermilab, where
Yeah.
I'm a staff member. And so what if we were to take the measuring device and pick it up and move it from New York to Illinois, and then we could use the more powerful accelerator, we could make more muons, we could do the measurement again. And that makes great sense until you find out that the facility that was used to measure the magnetic properties of a muon was a ring that was 50 feet across, so about 17 meters side to side.
Yep.
And well, that's pretty difficult. You certainly can't put it on a plane. You can't even put it easily on a truck because if you drive it, it will have to go
One way.
through,
Yeah.
it'll affect traffic. It's just hopeless. So what they did is they picked up this ring and put it on a barge, floated it down the east coast of the US, down to to basically near New Orleans, where they entered rivers and went up through the rivers a little bit on the Mississippi, but some other rivers up till they got close to Chicago, where they did pick it up, put it on a big truck, and they drove it at night, a little bit at a time, until they could get from the place where the boat was able to dock to
It's a
Fermilab.
mission. It's a big mission.
Right. Yeah. So that took, I mean, that was about 10 years ago that they did that. And it was very interesting. So
Know,
the net.
sometime a little bit of deviation. I hear scientists here at Brookhaven Lab speak about how they get the BARTs moving from California from Little Sprickly Lab to Brookhaven here, and how that was complicated to get. You need at some point they need the army help. We're getting one of the largest airplane to carry that that beast, and then how they move it through New York up to Long Island over here, step by step, and they have this picture. So I can imagine how complicated of a mission it is for scientists to do.
I'm sure it was. I wasn't part of it, but it was fascinating. We did see it. I was here. I saw the drive in when it arrived. We had a big crowd. It was all very fascinating. It was actually kind of funny because you had this the we call it a ring. So it's, I don't know, it's about, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 feet tall and 50 feet across. So, you know, a meter and a half tall, 17 meters wide, and it was covered by a tarp, and it looked all the world like a flying saucer. So I could easily see that people around here thought that, oh my gosh, you know, there's a big ring coming slow on a big truck surrounded by police cars with flashing lights. You know, I could easily imagine that they thought we were getting our UFO delivered.
It's also like,
So at any rate, we brought it here. We refurbished the detectors. This big circle was a very strong magnet, a very incredibly precise magnet. So we spent years validating it, making sure that the magnet was as good as we thought it would be, and to make sure that the magnetic field was extremely uniform. And we started doing the measurement. So now here at Fermilab, with the same ring, but with much improved detectors, with an improved, well, not an improved accelerator, but a stronger accelerator, which gave us more muons, allowed us to do a better job of measuring the magnetic properties
little
of
bit of
the
explanation here, you can correct me. So
muon.
the accelerator will give you the muons, and then you take the muons into the ring of the magnet when you're gonna make them align with the magnetic field. And
Yes.
then you have the detectors to detect the muons decay. So
Yes.
three process to reach that data that you will work with later.
I didn't get that last. Everything you said, I agreed, but I didn't get
Yeah,
that
so you
last
have
little
like
bit.
three processes. You have the accelerator to get the muons. You have
Yes.
the ring to collect those muons and do the magnetic properties of the muon. And then you have the detectors that will take the muon decay and turn it into information.
Correct. So the way that this detector works is really interesting. So it turns out that the process whereby the muons are made is a little complicated. We could talk about it if you want, but we take our accelerator, which is protons, we smash them into things to make pions. Pions are like light protons. They live a little while, then they decay and they make muons. So there's a multi-step process, but because of the nature of the forces involved and issues of quantum mechanics, when the muons are made, they have their when we it's not really fair to call them spin, but we kind of think of it as spin. So if you think of it as like a golf ball that's rotating, there's an axis that it rotates around. And so the axis that the muons are rotating around are in the same direction. And if you put them in a magnetic field, what happens is the this axis starts to rotate around like this. So if you've ever played with a top as a child, you spin it and you put it down, and what happens is the top just starts to do this. It's basically the same thing. So what happens is when the muon decays, it spits out a electrically, in this case, it turns out to be a thing called a positron, which is a positive electron, and it shoots it out in the direction of the axis. So as this thing's going around, there are many of them. I forget how many there are in the ring at any one time, but many million. And so what's happened is they're going around, they're decaying. Mm-hmm. And so if they decay, they shoot out an electron, a positron here, and then they come over, they shoot it out here. And so they're all decaying. And what you can do is you can watch where they're decaying. Mm-hmm. And that tells you where it's pointing. And if you time when these particles hit the detector, you can figure out how fast it's moving around. And that's what we're really measuring, is how fast the muon is doing this. Oops, get up here. Oh. The fact that it's doing this. Hmm. And so, but we're just looking at the direction, and by seeing where we measure it, we know where it's pointing, and that's what we're measuring. So we did that. And it turned out, so we ran for 6 years. So back in 2001, we announced the result of a single year of data. Not 2001, sorry, 2021.
Just
a couple of years ago. My apologies. And so that was as you say, that was really a big deal, because we wanted to find out if the Fermilab measurement and the Brookhaven measurement were the same.
Yeah.
If they were not the same, well, then one of us goofed up.
That's it. Yeah, that's the first time, how we work.
Right. And that, honestly, if you'd asked me a couple of years ago, I wouldn't have been at all surprised if that was the case, because it's a very hard measurement. Anytime you measure something with 10 digits, it's really hard to do that right. However, what we found was the Brookhaven measurement, the measurement announced in 2004, and a measurement announced in 2021 were the same. So the two experiments measured exactly the same thing. So that gave us some indication that the measurement was correct. Mm-hmm. So then there's the theory question, because the theory might be wrong. So this theory is incredibly difficult. And without a blackboard and a huge amount of equations, it would be very difficult for me to explain in detail how it's done. But what it boils down to is, as I said, we're really probing the nature of these particles that are appearing and disappearing in the vicinity of a muon. And so different particles can appear. In fact, what do they say in Russia? Anything that is not forbidden is compulsory. So anything that can happen will happen.
Yeah.
And so any kind of particle can appear in the vicinity of the muon, but some appear more than others. Mm-hmm. So if the particles that are appearing are electrons and their antimatter equivalent, you can calculate that very easily. Mm-hmm. And there are many particles that you can calculate. It's still a very difficult calculation, but theorists are very smart. They can figure out how to do that and do that very precisely. But sometimes what happens is the particles that are appearing in the vicinity of a muon are not electron and an antimatter electron, but a quark and an antimatter quark.
Okay.
Now, quarks are most normally found inside protons, and they have different properties than electrons. It turns out that they interact with each other very strongly. And if something interacts very strongly, that turns out to be mathematically difficult to calculate exactly how it works.
Yes.
And so while it's possible to do, because it's strong, maybe you make a mistake. So in the original theory calculations before, say, 2000, what happened was the theorists would say, this little piece where these quarks are interacting with one another, this is very, very difficult to calculate reliably. So what we'll do is we'll be clever. We will take this little piece of the calculation and not calculate it. Instead, what we'll do is we'll reach over here to this other experiment, and this experiment has made a measurement that measures that. So we have this long calculation with lots of math and this hard part, this very tiny hard part that we say, well, let's not do that. We'll throw it away. We'll take this experiment and put it in there. Mm. And that's our full prediction. So it's not entirely theoretical. It's theoretical, a little bit of experiment. And so that measurement, that prediction there, and our measurement disagreed with one another. And so that is what was going on 1 year ago. Now, as it turns out, the same day that my laboratory announced this measurement that was done here at Fermilab, another theory group said, we have another way to calculate the theory. So what we're going to do is we're not going to do that cheating thing. What we're going to do is we are going to take that very difficult part and apply a new calculational technique that requires a huge amount of computing power. And we're just going to let the computer crunch it. Mm-hmm. So we're now going to make a prediction that is completely theoretical without any experimental input. And what do we get? So remember what we had before, where we had a theoretical prediction, an experimental prediction, and after the new measurement, they did disagree. But when we asked someone, when this new group said, well, we have a different prediction, this different prediction was actually in between the two. So where here, you know, here's the measurement, here is the prediction with the experimental work. But now if you do the new prediction that is just with the calculation, it turns out to be here. It's closer.
Okay.
Still disagrees, but, you know, it's between the two, basically.
Yeah, I was thinking when I saw this, how you explained it and the picture in my head, it's like, what is the main difference? We know that QED, now QCD can play a role. And then putting all our knowledge, I expect, yeah, we might have a disagreement, but not as big. You might have some disagreement. But
you are now relying, remember, on that experiment, that outside experiment, to be right.
Yes.
Now, we trust that those experimenters were good guys, that they did a good job. But, you know, I'm an experimenter and mistakes are made. And sometimes you do your best. You know, you something you didn't take into account is true. So that was the situation from 2021. You had two experimental measurements that agreed with each other. You had two theoretical predictions, one of which was pure theory and one of which was a mix of theory and experiment. And those two didn't agree with each other. So that makes you nervous. The theory should agree with each other. The experiment should agree with each other. And ideally, the theory and the experiment should agree with each other. But the fact that the two theories disagreed suggested that the uncertainty was on the theory side and not on the experiment side. So now we move to the recent measurement, which was a week ago. And in this case, the experimenters, remember I said they had 6 years of data, and the first measurement announcement that they made 2 years ago was 1 year of data. Now the measurement that they made a week ago was 3 years of data. So the first year and two more years.
Okay.
So the first question is, does the second 2 years of data agree with the first? And the answer is yes. So now all of the Fermilab measurements agree with the Brookhaven measurements. All of the measurements agree. On the theory side, it's more mysterious because we had the mixed measurement, which is partial data and partial theory, and the pure theory measurement. They disagreed. Well, there is a group at the University of Illinois at Champaign, which is called the Muon Theory Initiative, and they have been working very hard to try and make this better.
Very interesting.
And so one of the things they did is say, well, let's grab a measurement from a different experiment. Let's do the same thing we did before, calculate everything except for the hard part, take that out, but now let's get a measurement from a different experiment, put that in. Well, it turns out when they do that, they get a third answer. So that's worrisome. What that means is that the theoretical situation is messy. And that's not a criticism. It's incredibly difficult. Anytime you do anything with 10 digits, it's very hard. But
including QCD will make it more harder.
Exactly. So that is basically the status right now. If it turned out that the three theory estimates were the same, the two experimental estimates were the same, and they'd still disagreed, then I would say that I think that this is strong evidence that there is some undiscovered physics. But that's not the situation we're in now. We have what seems to be a very precise and reliable experimental measurement, but we have at least three distinct theory predictions. And so that suggests that the problem is that one or maybe all three of these theoretical predictions aren't right. Now, if it turns out that the most recent prediction, which is, as I remind you, is mostly theory with a little bit of experiment, well, that new one, the newest one, is almost the same as the experiment. So if that becomes the case, then there is no discrepancy between theory and prediction. And that means that that's great. That means that QED, this advanced quantum calculation, is good. So that's fantastic. That's the strength of the theory. But it's also a little disappointing, because if they do disagree, it gives us a place to look for new potential physics. So we're very happy on one hand, and on the other, happy it wouldn't be so bad if they disagreed. But anyways, that's where the status is right now. It appears to me that the theory situation is a little bit of a mess, and it will take significant work to resolve this, because what they're going to have to do to resolve this is to look very deeply into those two experiments that gets added to the calculation. And if we can find that one of them's just wrong, well, you throw it out. But if they're not wrong, then that's very troubling. And then the other option is the pure theory calculation, where they basically did this difficult measurement with brute force computer power. And so new groups are trying to reproduce that result with more powerful computers and with more precision, attempting to verify that the previous calculation, which was done a couple of years ago, in fact, was done accurately. And the estimate is for them to be sure that they can reproduce it, and that to be positive of the precision of the reproduction will take a couple of years. Because when you do 10 digits, you want to make sure that you don't goof up. And then it'll take probably a couple of years for the group to reevaluate all of that experimental input, make sure it was implemented properly, make sure there were no conceptual errors in translating that experimental measurement into the theoretical prediction. So we are looking at a couple of years, I think, of the theorists trying to resolve the theoretical situation. And on that same time scale, another perhaps 2 years or so, I'm not exactly sure, the experimental group here at Fermilab will release the final 3 years of their data. And at which point, all 6 years of the data here at Fermilab will be released. Now, the goal was always that the measurement at Fermilab would reduce the uncertainties from the Brookhaven measurement of 20 years ago by a factor of 4. So it would be a quarter the size of what it was 20 years ago. As it stands right now, it's half the size.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's already a significant improvement over the 2004 measurement. But they're hoping that they will be able to reduce the uncertainty by another factor of 2. And then at that point, I think the situation is wholly within the theoretical community's responsibility.
I think that's pretty great. It's an exciting time when I hear how this discrepancy appears, how you guys do a great job at Fermilab. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more, as an experimentalist, I can imagine how complicated it is and how hard it is to squeeze this error bars in every time you want to squeeze it a little bit. That's mean more data, more quality assurance work had to be done, and too many of great scientists had to have come together to solve these problems, and everything had to work fine. But as you summarize it, we had now a very accurate measurement that will be more accurate than it is already in the next 2 years. Your data had been a revet for the Brookhaven National Laboratory data that's had been already 20 years old. So we have two experimental measurements, two different labs, two different people, several groups that's confirming this experimental measurement. I can imagine how trustable is this data is. And on the other side, mm-hmm. has three theory predictions. One that's purely theoretical, that's close to the data, but there are some discrepancy, and an old measurement, an old calculation that use an experimental input, and this is totally disagree with the data, and a new theoretical calculation with an experimental input that shows a very good agreement with the data. And the state of art that we're going to have to wait about 2 to 3 years to hopefully get resolve that situation on the theory level, and we can come up either we maybe have a new physics to look for, or everything is, as my advisor will always say, hunky-dory, and we look for something else to do. But
yes,
that's state of art.
I think you summed it up perfectly.
And you explained it more than perfect, Dan. Like, I really, really appreciate your time, and would like to, as an end of that discussion, I would like to thank you a lot. It's been a fantastic discussion, as always, with you. And I hope the audience and, you know, English speaker and Arabic speaker, since this is going to be translated, to gain mm-hmm. a lot from that and see how fascinated it is not only to speak about science, but also to act and participate in these experiments. Thank you so much for agreeing, and thank you so much for devoting that time for us.
You're quite welcome, always.
Thank you so much.